Today's shiur has been dedicated by Eric Sable, Le'ilei Nishmas, his mother, Bracha Bas David, on her yard site. The schus of Torah learning from this shiur should provide the neshama with a continuous aliyah. And we are near the bottom of Yud Aleph Amid Beis, beginning the new Mishnah. This Mishnah continues to discuss the rabbinic decree that we started the Masechta with, which stated that within 3 days of a pagan festival, a Jew may not conduct business with idolaters, observing that pagan festival, lest the Jew thereby facilitate an idolatrous sacrifice, or the issue could be that it might cause the idolater to go and thank his deity. So Mishnah today begins, Ir sheyesh ba avodas kochavim. Let's say there is a city that is populated by idolaters who will be observing some pagan festival. And so, of course, the rabbinic decree against the commerce near that pagan festival will apply to that city. But says the Mishnah, Chutza Allah, people living outside of that city, mutter, it is permitted to engage in commerce with them near the pagan festival of the nearby city. That is, the halacha does not obligate us to assume that just because this other population center is within close proximity to a city of pagans that will be observing some upcoming idolatrous festival, that they too observe the same festival. We don't have to assume that unless we know that, of course. Rather, we assume that the city outside has their own pagan festivals, and therefore we needn't be stringent with respect to engaging in commerce with the outer city when there's a pagan festival going on by the inner city. Conversely, the Mishnah says, Hayachutz Allah avodas kochavim. If let's say the outside city is observing some pagan festival, tocha mutter. As far as the inner city, it's not a problem to engage in commerce with them near the outer city's pagan festival. The Mishnah continues, Mahu leilech lisham. What about simply going there, traveling to a city when they're currently having some pagan festival? That is, even where this person is not going to engage in commerce, let's say he needs to have a conversation with somebody in that city, would that be a problem? Says the Mishnah, it might be a problem. That is, bizman shaderech miyuchedes laoso makom, assuming that the road he's using to travel to that city clearly only leads to the city in question where they're observing some pagan festival, then it will be prohibited to simply go there, because this would create problematic optics. It doesn't look good, which we call marasayin, the principle that a person may not even engage in behavior that appears problematic. And so if it's clear to the onlooker that, clearly this person is headed to the city where they're having an idolatrous festival, then that would be prohibited. However, v'yimhaya yochel lahalech bo l'mokum acher mutter. If the road or perhaps highway in question doesn't only lead to that city, you could go other places using that road, then it would not be a problem, for it need not be construed as this person is heading to a city that's currently having an idolatrous festival. So in that case, it would be permitted. Mar begins by asking, regarding the Mishnah's first point, that we don't have to presume that a nearby city is observing the same pagan festival. The Gemara asks, Heichi dami chutzala. What exactly are the circumstances of the Mishnah's teaching about this city, outside of the pagan city? That is, how near may the city be where we can still assume that, no, it's its own city, it's its own identity, and unless we know otherwise, we don't have to assume that they adopt the same pagan festival. And so, commerce with them would not be prohibited if the inner city is having some pagan festival. The Gemara answers, I'm Rabbi Shimon, min lakish mishum Rabbi Chanina. He says, kagon at loza shel Aza. An example of the kind of case the Mishnah is referring to would be the marketplace of Aza, which was situated right outside of the city of Aza. So Mish Lakish appears to be saying that even where this other community is right outside of the city where we know there's some pagan festival now, nevertheless, it's not an issue. We don't have to assume that this other community adopts the same pagan festival. Gemara now presents a different version of this. V'yekid yarmi to those that say, this is what happened. Ba minei Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish me Rabbi Chanina. Mish Lakish had asked Rabbi Chanina the following question. Let's say we have a situation of like at loza shel Aza mau. If the other community in question was so close to this city where we know there's a pagan festival, like for example, let's say the marketplace of Aza, so it's just outside of Aza, what would be the halacha in that case? We continue to say that we're not obligated to assume that the other community also observes that pagan festival. That's what Rish Lakish asked Rabbi Chanina. Now, Amar Leh, Rabbi Chanina answered with a rhetorical question. He said, Lo alachta l'tzor miyamecha, have you never gone to the city of Tzor, v'ra'isa Yisrael, v'yovid kochavim, and seen there a Jew and an idolater, continuing to Yudbezim and Aleph, sheshavsu shtei kederos agabi kiro achas, putting two pots on one stove, you know, one pot each, one from the Jew, one from the idolater, and have you not observed that the chachamim were not concerned about this situation of an idolater's pot and a Jew's pot cooking right next to each other in the same stove? So Chanina is saying, using this analogy, we can glean that we are also able to be lenient in our situation that deals with a community that's in close proximity with this other community that's observing an idolatrous festival. The Gemara asks, "My lo chashulam chachamim?" What precisely was Rabbi Chanina's intention here when he said, "Oh, look, in that case, the Rabbanan were not concerned"? And so too over here, what specific point or points do we learn from this analogy? The Gemara will present three interpretations of the analogy, you know, in terms of what exactly we are extrapolating from this analogy to our case. So we begin with Amar Abaye. Abaye said that included in Rabbi Chanina's answer was that he was pointing out that the Rabbanan allowed the situation of a Jew cooking with his pot next to the idolater's pot, and they were not concerned. They didn't prohibit this situation, mishum besar nevelo, on the grounds of, well, one second, maybe some non-kosher meat from the idolater's pot ended up in the Jewish person's pot. That is, lo amrinan, Chanina is pointing out that in that situation we do not say, a halacha does not obligate us to be concerned, dilma mahadra pe Yisrael le'achore, v'shadi ovid kochavim nevela b'kedera. Perhaps the Jew turned away for a second, and while he was looking the other way, the idolater went and took some of his non-kosher meat and threw it in the Jew's pot. Yeah, of course, if that did happen, you'd be dealing with a biblical prohibition. Of course, the Torah itself prohibits a Jew from eating meat that was not, you know, properly slaughtered with the ritual slaughter. And so even though when it comes to a biblical prohibition, we have to be, you know, more stringent as a general rule, nevertheless, the Rabbanan were not concerned for that possibility, that this idolater, you know, threw his non-kosher meat into the Jew's pot. And so with this, Rabbi Chanina is pointing out that the Chavusa Hachanami, the Rabbanan were similarly not concerned about a potential biblical prohibition in our case, that is, Lo chashulem chachavim mishum dimei avodas kochavim. The Rabbanan would similarly say in our situation that even though this Adluza Shel Aza is in close proximity with Aza, and in Aza, they are offering sacrifices to their idols today, and it's possible, therefore, that the people in Aza are taking things of value, let's say a gold or even money, and they're bringing that to their idols. And if so, you could argue, you know, maybe there's a possibility, maybe we have to be concerned that some of that idolatrous money ended up in the outer community of Adluza Shel Aza, and that now this idolater wants to purchase something from a Jew in the marketplace of Aza is using idolatrous money. Let's say, for example, again, the money was like brought to an idol. Now, if it was brought to an idol, that money would be biblically forbidden. Based on the pasuk of Lo yidbak biyadecha me'uma min acherem, the Torah forbids any benefit from things banned, specifically idolatrous material, especially something that was brought to an idol. That would be biblically forbidden from any benefit. But Rabbi Chanina is learning from this analogy, saying, well, just like the rabbis weren't concerned about the nevela meat getting to the Jew's pot, even though it's right next to the idolater's pot, the same thing over here. Just because there's a proximity between Aza and Atluza Shel Aza, we're not obligated to be concerned about the possibility that biblically forbidden idolatrous money ended up in the community of Atluza Shel Aza. Now, if the Rabbanan were not concerned about a biblical prohibition, again, the nevela prohibition in the case of the pots, well, it's certainly the halacha would not obligate us to be concerned about the possibility of a rabbinic prohibition that, well, maybe this person of Adluza Shel Aza chose to adopt the pagan custom of the nearby city, and so there would be a rabbinic prohibition. You know, certainly, if we're only dealing, you know, potentially with the rabbinic prohibition, the halacha would not obligate us to be concerned about that. That is how Abaye understands Rabbi Chanina's analogy. However, the Gemara now presents a different understanding, and that is Rava Omar. Rava said, you know, this is the meaning of Rabbi Chanina's statement. My lo chashulam chachamim. What exactly was Rabbi Chanina saying here? What was he pointing out from this case of the two pots next to each other, that there the rabbis were concerned? So same thing over here. Rava dismisses Abaye's interpretation. For Rava says it's not really a fair comparison in terms of the potential biblical prohibition there. For Rava says, why should we be concerned in that case of the pots that the idolater went and threw his nevela meat into the Jew's pot? First of all, what does he have to gain from that? Second of all, if he's caught in the act, then the Jew will sue him for causing him a loss. He has to throw out all of his food. So Rava argues that, of course, in that case, you don't have to be worried about the biblical prohibition of nevela. As opposed to the equivalent question by Luza Shalaza, maybe indeed this idolater from Adluza Shalaza is doing his friend from Aza a favor, and he agreed to take his idolatrous money and go and purchase something from him, from this Jewish merchant. So it's not really a fair comparison. Instead, Rav explains, the focus of Rabbi Hanina's statement, he says, there, by the two pots is no problem, he's referring to that there, the Rabbanim were not concerned, Mishum Bishulei Ovdei Kochav. Because of the potential issue that maybe this Yisrael asked this idolater to go and cook the food for him. Now, if that really happened, then the food in the Jew's pot would become rabbinically prohibited under the decree of Bishulei Ovdei Kochavim, or more commonly referred to as Bishulakim. The Rabbanan said that we cannot have an idolater, or even any non-Jew, cook food for a Jew as a safeguard so that a Jew should not become too close to other influences, to other peoples. It might end up intermarrying. So to make a separation, the Rabbanan said, a non-Jew may not cook a Jewish person's food. Yet the Rabbanan were not concerned for this possibility. Even though the pots are right next to each other, Rabbanan do not obligate us to be concerned that maybe the Jew here relied on the non-Jew to go and cook his food for him. And so Rabbi Chanina's point is, the chavusa hachanami, the equivalent would be true in our case regarding doing business with the people of Atluza Shalaza, who are in close proximity to the people of Aza, who have a pagan festival. We can extrapolate from the case of the two pots that we don't have to be concerned that maybe the people in Atluza Shalaza are also observing the idolatrous festival, and therefore a Jew would not be able to engage in commerce with them. No, that's not the halacha. We don't have to be concerned for that rabbinic prohibition. That is how Rava explains the analogy. We have a third interpretation of Rabba Bar Ula Amar. Rabba Bar Ula dismisses Rava's reading, for he points out that really the rabbinic prohibition of Bishulakim is not at all relevant to the case of the two pots. For the halacha is, as long as the Jew started the process, as in our case, he placed that pot on the fire, it would not be a problem at all to have the non-Jew take over and finish the cooking process. As opposed to our case of Adluza Shalaza, where there really is a potential concern that maybe this person at Luza Shalaz is also observing the pagan festival, and so it would be rabbinically forbidden to do business with him today. Rather, Rabbi Bar Ula explains, and this is what Rav Chanina was saying, he is pointing out that the Rabbanan permitted the Jew to eat the contents in his pot, and they did not say that we're obligated to be concerned that perhaps some of the contents from the idolater's pot splashed and some of that fell into the Jew's pot. They weren't concerned from that, even though the pots are right next to each other. And there are two reasons why they were not concerned. First of all, it's simply not very probable that that happened. And even if it did, there would be a biblical principle to rely on of a bittul berov, which says that if there's a tiny amount of non-kosher mixed into some kosher food, the halacha technically says that the non-kosher part loses its identity. It gets lost in the mixture, and the entire mixture is deemed kosher. So when combining these two factors, the Rabbanan said the halacha is it's permitted. And the analogy goes like this, the chavusa hachanami. So to be here, in our case, regarding doing business with the people of Adluza Shalaza, Lo chashulahem chacham mishum lifnei edehen. Rabbanu were not concerned with the problem of doing business with these people before the upcoming pagan festival that will be observed in the nearby Aza. For in this case as well, there are two factors that provide a basis to be lenient. First of all, the basic assumption is that this is a person from a different community. It might be nearby community that is soon observing a pagan festival, but that doesn't really, you know, create a strong likelihood that this person at Luza is observing the same festival. And even if we're wrong, even if it turns out that he too will observe the upcoming pagan festival, he is not observing the festival today. Rabba Barula is understanding that we're specifically referring to the question of the 3 days before the pagan festival, where, you know, normally the Rabbanans say that if we know for a fact that there's an upcoming pagan festival, then the rabbinic prohibition against commerce extends for 3 days before that festival. But of course, it's an extension to say that, you know, even business transactions 3 days in advance of the pagan festival will, let's say, cause the pagan to go and thank his idol. That concern, of course, is not nearly as significant as, you know, doing business with the idolater on the festival itself. So when taking those two things into consideration, that again, he may not be observing the pagan festival at all, even if he does, who says to go and thank his idol, if he does a business transaction before the festival, therefore the rabbinic prohibition does not apply. But Rashi points out that indeed, according to Rabba Barula's interpretation here, there would be an issue with transacting business with people from Matluza Shalazo on the pagan festival itself. Our Mishnah then discussed the potential problem of creating an appearance of participating in an idolatrous festival. Like if somebody travels that city on the day they're having the idolatrous festival. So the Gemara brings a braisa that discusses this issue. Tan Rabbanan. The Rabbanan taught in a braisa, Ir sheyesh ba avodas kochavim, asur likanes lisocha, velom visocha liir acheres. Divrei Rabbi Meir. The Meir in the braisa reiterates, first of all, what the Mishnah said, that one may not travel to a city on the day they're having an idolatrous festival, nor may a Jew be seen traveling from that city. That too will create the impression that, hey, this Jew was participating in the pagan festival. So that would be prohibited too. That's according to Rabbi Meir. The Braisa continues, V'chachamim omrim, the Chachamim, however, say, the distinction that we saw in the Mishnah, that kol zman she'aderech miuchedes le'oso makom aser, if the road in question leads only to that city where they're holding an idolatrous festival, then it's prohibited. It's marisayin. It looks bad. However, ein aderech miuchedes li'osa makom mutter. If the road in question doesn't lead only to that place, that city of the idolatrous festival, then it's permitted because it need not be construed that he's going necessarily to that city. The Braisa relates more halachos. The Braisa says, Yashiv lo kotz bifnei avodas kochavim. Let's say somebody got a splinter or some thorn got stuck in him and he was happened to be in front of an idol. He wants to bend down to take the thorn out. Says the Braisa, he can't do it. Lo yishchav yitlena, he may not bend down to remove the thorn bifnei shenira kimishtachav ala avodas kochavim. Because then it would appear, even though it's not really his intention, but there's an appearance there that he's bowing to an idol. So he can't do it. The Braisa continues, though, Vimeno Nira, as the Gemara will explain later, if he does it in a way that it doesn't appear that he's bowing to the idol, let's say like he's bowing in a different direction to remove the thorn than mutter, then it would be permitted. The Braisa also rules, if nispazru lo ma'osaf ifnei avodas kochavim. Let's say a guy dropped all of his coins and got scattered before an idol. The halach is lo yishcha v'yitle. He may not bend down to gather his coins. Because then it would appear that he's bowing to this idol. But again, v'meinu nira mutter. But if he's not doing it in a way that it looks like he's bowing to the idol, then it would be permitted. And the Braisa continues, mayon hamoshech lifnei avodas kochavim. If there was a spring that flowed before an idol, lo yishcha v'yishta. This person may not bend down to go and drink from the spring, mipnei shenirek mishtachav alavodus kochavim. Because again, then it would appear that he's bowing before an idol, v'meino nira. But if he's not doing it in a way that looks like he's bowing to that idol, then mutter. Then it would be permitted. The Braisa rules further, partsufos mekalchen mayim lekrachet. Regarding these idolatrous sculptures, we have like a water fountain, the water spews forth from the mouth of the idolatrous statue. The halacha is, lo yaniach piv al piyem v'yishta. He may not place his mouth on the mouth of the statue to drink the water. Mipnei shenira k'menashek l'avodas kochavim. Because then it appears like he is kissing this idolatrous statue. So that would be prohibited. Kiyotzibon, similarly, that is another halacha that applies to drinking water, is that lo yaniach piv al silon v'yishta. Person is not allowed to simply place his mouth on a pipe that's, you know, coming from the ground that brings up water. He can't simply go and drink from that water. It's referring to where there's no, like, you know, filtration system. It's just, you know, water coming from, whatever source it is, he can't do the mipnei sakana, because it's dangerous. The Gemara in the next Amid will talk about water leeches. So the point is, if things in the water that could be dangerous, could endanger a person's health, could endanger his life, so the halacha is you must first inspect the water and make sure there's nothing dangerous in there. The Gemara begins to analyze the Braisa, and the Gemara asks, "My eno nira? What did the Braisa mean that if he doesn't appear to be bowing to the idol, then it's permitted? If we interpret the Braisa that it's saying that if no one's around, he's not seen by anybody, then it's permitted. The Gemara says that can't be the meaning. For Rav Yomar, Rav Yehuda Marav, for Rav Yehuda Marav said, the way this works is, kol makom she'asru chachamim mipnei maris ayin, any activity that the Rabbanan said is forbidden because of the problem of Marasayin, it appears he is doing a prohibited activity. The halacha is, afilu b'chadre chadarim aser, even if he wants to do that activity in the innermost private chambers, it's still prohibited. Rabbanan issued a blanket decree. They said, once this activity is prohibited, it's always prohibited. It doesn't matter if there's nobody around in this particular case. And so the above braisa can't be saying, as long as nobody's around, that it's fine to do something, even though it appears like he's bowing to the idol. And so the Gemara explains instead, Elaim, rather say, this is the braisa's intention. The braisa is saying that if the way he is stooping down to do whatever he needs to do is im eino nira kimishtacha velavudus kochavim, is not in a way that it appears at all like he's bowing to the idol, because he's bowing in a different direction, away from the idol, let's say, then mutter, then it would be permitted, even though he's like in front of an idol, but there's no appearance at all. The act he's doing does not even appear to be an act of bowing to the idol. So in that case, the Braisa says it would be permitted. The Gemara now explains why the Braisa needed all of these cases. Seemingly, the Braisa could have taught one of the cases, and we could have extrapolated on our own that in these other situations where it looks like he's bowing to the idol, it would be a problem. But the Gemara explains that, in fact, Utsricha, the Braisa needed to teach these various scenarios, these different rulings, because the Itana Kotz, had the Braisa only taught us the case where he has a thorn stuck in him and he wants to bend down to remove it, that in that situation he may not bend down and remove it in a way that it even looks like he's bowing to the idol, I would have said, Mishum de Efshar lemezel kameyu mishkale, that okay, in that case, the Rabbanan obligated him to be stringent because it's possible to just move to a different place and remove that thorn. Just do it somewhere else where it doesn't appear like he's bowing to the idol. Avol ma'os dilo efshar. But in the case where he dropped his money, the money's spread around before the idol, where he doesn't have the option to do it somewhere else, then he has to pick up this money. And so it could be unavoidable to appear like he's bowing to the idol. So Emilah, I might have said that the Rabbanan were not that stringent, and rather, okay, if it's unavoidable, he can bend down and get his money. He doesn't have to worry about the marasayin that it looks like he's bowing to an idol. So the Braisa therefore clarifies that no, one has to be stringent in the money case too. The Gemara continues, v'itana mos, but if the Braisa only taught the money case, I might have said, okay, in that case, one has to be stringent because in the end, all we're talking about is the mamona. He's losing some money. It's not the end of the world, and so the Rabbanan demand that he be stringent. Avol kotz titzara. But in the situation where he has a thorn stuck in him, so he's in pain, he's in physical suffering, perhaps the Rabbanan were lenient in that situation. Same Allah might have said that he doesn't have to be stringent, therefore the Braisa mentions the thorn case too, and it teaches that no, he has to be stringent there. He can't bend down to remove that thorn, even if it's causing him pain. He may not do so in a way that there's a marasayin that it appears he's bowing to the idol. The Gemara continues, V'itana hani tarti. Now the Braisa only taught the thorn case and the money case. We might have said that, okay, there, the rabbis demanded that we be stringent, mishum deleka sakana, because being stringent in those cases does not entail any danger, doesn't endanger this person's life. Avol mayan, but in the water case, he needs to drink the ikka sakana, where we could even be referring to a situation where his life is in danger, he's dying of thirst. And so the ilosha simayas, if he doesn't drink now, he's going to die. Therefore, imelo. Therefore, I might have said that, okay, it's life and death here. So the Rabbanan did not impose their stringency. Comes along the Braisa to teach us that not true. Rather, even if his life is in danger, so be it, he would have to sacrifice his life, if need be, rather than do an act which has the appearance of idol worship. And so this case teaches a novel point indeed, namely that a Jew's obligation to sacrifice his life rather than transgress one of the cardinal sins, and of course one of those sins is idol worship, that obligation includes even when you're talking about a rabbinic prohibition. Bezraya d'Avodah Zarah. It's, you know, an offshoot of the actual Avodah Zarah prohibition. Of course, the Jew here is not actually intending to worship the idol, and yet, since this is a prohibition that's connected with idol worship, it falls under the rule of Yareg v'Yavor, that he has to allow himself to be killed rather than transgress. Of course, if he's able to drink in a way that avoids appearing that he's bound to the idol, then that's what he should do. He should stay alive and drink. Hence, we see Tzricha, why these different cases were all needed. But turning to Amid Beis, the Gemara asks, Partzufos Lamali, why did the Braisa also need to teach this case of the idolatrous statue where you have water as a fountain coming out of the mouth that the person can't put his mouth on the statue's mouth to drink? Because again, that appears like idol worship, like he's kissing the idol. This ruling appears to be redundant. We already, you know, basically made that point in the previous cases. The Gemara answers, Mishum dekebayi lemisni. Gemara says, you're right. The point of representing this ruling wasn't really for the ruling of, you know, this case at hand. Rather, this case serves to introduce the ruling that follows of Kiyotzibali Anich Pivagabi Asilon Vyishna Mipnea Sakana, namely the ruling about the person can't, you know, go and drink from some water pipe coming out of the ground, because that would be dangerous. Like, to introduce that, you know, related halacha, first we talk about an equivalent halacha of, you know, Marzayan of Avodah Zarah, putting his mouth on where the water is coming out of the statue's mouth, and that, you know, segues into this, you know, other halacha involving, you know, sakana, that he can't, you know, go and drink from a pipe coming out of the ground. The Gemara now clarifies, my sakana, what danger is involved if he directly drinks from the pipe coming out of the ground without inspecting the water first. The Gemara says, aluka, the danger is maybe there's a leech in there, and if he ingests that, it could be dangerous. The Gemara now brings a brisa on this topic. Tan Rabbanan, the Rabbanan Tan brisa. Halacha is lo yishte adam mayim lo mina naros v'lo mina hagamim. Person can't, like, directly drink from rivers or ponds lo bepiv, not, you know, directly with his mouth v'lo biyadav achas, and not even if he is scooping it with one hand, because if he's scooping it with one hand, he's going to quickly put it to his mouth before properly inspecting it, because otherwise he's going to drop all the water. So he can't drink in these ways. Rather, he has to scoop it with two hands or put in a container to get a good look, inspect the water, make sure there's nothing dangerous in there, or maybe filter it even. The Braisa says, V'im shasa, if he went ahead and ignored this advice, and he just went and drank it right from the river without inspecting the water, Dama Barosho, his blood is on his own head. Like, if he gets sick and even dies from this, that's his own fault, Mpnea Sakana, because he has endangered himself. My Sakana, what's the danger? As we said above, Sakana Saluka, that he might swallow a leech that's in this water that he's drinking. The Gemara points out, Misayale the Rabbi Chanina. The Braisa then supports the following statement of Rabbi Chanina. The Amr Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Chanina said, Balea Nima Shalmayim, who swallows a water leech, Mutter Lahachem Lo Chamin B'Shabbos, will be permitted to cook, to heat up water on Shabbos, to give to this a person who has swallowed a leech. That is, the Chanina is saying, if he swallows a water leech, his life is in danger now. Since his life is in danger, of course, it's permitted to even do a malach on Shabbos to address that dangerous situation. Chanina's assertion is supported by the previous brisa that stated that indeed, if one ingests a water leech, it puts his life in danger. And the Gemara relates to Maisa Be'echa Chabal Anima Shamayim. Once this happened, a person ingested this water leech on Shabbos. V'hiter Rabbi Nechemya Lachim Locham B'Shabbos. Nechemya permitted water to be cooked up for this person on Shabbos. And Adahachi V'hachi, in the meanwhile, while the water was being prepared, Amar Rav Huna Berede of Yeshua Ligma Chala. Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua, advised, let him take some vinegar, which could help, you know, offset the dangerous effects of the leech or waiting for the hot water. The Gemara brings a related statement. Amar Rav Idi Baravin, I mande bala zibura, if somebody swallowed a hornet, Michi Lachaye, he's for sure not going to live. Miu L'Shakye Rav Yasa D'Chala Shamgaz. However, let him take a revius of very strong vinegar. Efshar the chayipurta, the mafka, the base, this might buy him some time, might prolong his life a little bit so that he could arrange his affairs before he dies. The Gemara brings a related brisa, Tana Rabbanan, the Rabbanan Tani brisa, lo yishta ad mayim belaila. Person should not drink water at night. And the brisa is not referring to any danger about the water itself, even if the water itself is fine. Venturing, you know, by himself to go and drink that water in the middle of the night has a different danger, and that is the danger of the demon Shavriri. As the Gemara will state, says the brisa of Imshasa, if he ignores this advice, Dama Barosha, his blood is on his own head, Mipnei HaSakana, because it's dangerous to do this. The Gemara explains, "My sakana, what the danger is this? Sakana shavriri. It's a danger from the demon shavriri, who might encounter him if he goes out by himself in the middle of the night to go drink water." Tosas then replaces, mentions that we're not frequented anymore by demons. The Gemara says, "Vim tzachi maitakante." Well, let's say he's very thirsty, he wants to go get a drink. What should one do to avoid any danger from the demon shavriri? So says the Gemara, "Yika achrina badeh." If there's somebody else with him, literay, he should even wake him up. Velei malei tzachini maya. You should tell him, "I'm very thirsty, I need to get a drink, please accompany me." That will help, because if he's accompanied by another person, Shaviri will likely not try attacking him. V'ilo, if there's nobody else with him, then you should do as follows. Nikarkesh b'nichtema atzavta. You should go and shake the lid of his container of water there. Make noise with it, so that like it seems there's somebody else with him. V'neima iul enavshen. He should say as follows. Planya bar planisa. He should state his own name and say the son of planisa, his mother's name. And he should say, "Amra lach imach. Your mother has said, yizayir mishav rire, vrire, rire, yire, re." So the idea is he's like slowly shortening the demon's name all the way down till Ray, till one syllable, just the Ray part. Because he chivare in white cups, and apparently by like taking away the demon's name, that will shoo the demon away. We now begin the next Mishnah, which says, "Ir sheyeshba vodas kochavim." Let's say again, we have a city that is holding some idolatrous festival. Says the Mishnah, "V'hayu b'chanuyos mutaros v'sheinim mutaros." Some of the idolatrous stores in town had these particular kind of decorations. Others didn't have the decorations. Rashi mentions one of the Gemara's interpretations that significance of the decorations is that it displayed that this particular store would be paying taxes to the idolatrous priests, to the idol. The Mishnah says, "Zeha yamaisa b'Beis Shan." This was an actual case that occurred in Beis Shan. The question was posed of whether a Jew could patronize any of these stores. V'yamru chacham, and the chachamim said, they ruled, "Hama utaros asuros." The stores that were decorated with these decorations are prohibited for the Jew to shop at that store. V'she'enam utaros mutaros. Those that were not decorated are permitted for the Jew to go and purchase things from those stores. Now there's a glaring question on the Mishnah, which is, how could we be discussing the possibility of it being permitted to go and patronize a store in this city that's having an idolatrous festival? What happened to the basic rabbinic decree that we started the Masechta with, that bans commerce even 3 days before the pagan festival, and certainly on the pagan festival itself? So Rashi answers, when it comes to business transactions, buying and selling, Rabbanan only prohibited the type of buying or selling that would give this idolater joy and thereby cause him to go and thank his idol. But, Rashi says, the prohibition would not apply with respect to purchasing durable goods from idolatrous merchants. For the presumption is that this idolater is only selling this item, which could last a long time, because he's compelled to. He has to sell it, to liquidate it, to get the cash. So it's not going to give him any particular joy. So our Mishnah is discussing that there might still be a potential problem to go and purchase this durable thing from an idolater in a city where they're having a pagan festival. The Mishnah makes this distinction between the decorated stores and the non-decorated stores. The Gemara begins with the dispute of Amoraim as to what exactly is the problem of purchasing these things from the pagan stores when the stores are decorated. The Gemara begins with Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, "Lo shanu elo miutaros beverid v'hadas." When the Mishnah says that a Jew is not allowed to purchase anything from the pagan stores that are decorated, it's only referring to where the store is decorated, for example, with roses or myrtle. The point is that the decorations emit a nice fragrance. The presumption is that these nice-smelling plants that are decorating the store were actually offered to the town's idol. And so the issue here is that if the Jew would go and patronize that store, he would be taking in that fragrance of something that was offered to an idol, which would be prohibited. He's benefiting from something brought to an idol, therefore you can't go in that store. That's what the Mishnah is saying. That again, since these things smell nice, the kabesani mirecha is benefiting from the nice fragrance that they emit. Avol mi'utaras bipeiros. But if it's other decorations, let's say some fruits, and it's not giving off any particular smell, you can't really pick up any fragrance, mutaras, then it would be permitted. Assuming again, it doesn't fall under the scope of the general rabbinic decree against your business with the pagan cities when they're having a pagan festival, there would be no other issue in this case. It would be permitted, even though Rish Lakish does agree that the decorations are a sign that the owner of this store will contribute some of his proceeds to the idol. So the Jew, at least indirectly, is benefiting the idol. Nevertheless, it's permitted. My time, what's the reason? Says Rish Lakish, the Amar Krav, the Pasuk says, what is prohibited? Velo yidbak biyadacha me'uma min acherem. Torah says, you may not take from any of the banned property, referring to the idolatrous property. So Rish Lakish infers from the Pasuk's language, nena hu de'asur. The Torah is prohibiting the Jew from benefiting from idolatrous property. Tinimik to Yud Gimel Amin Aleph. But in the other direction, if it turns out the Jew benefited an idol, of course it wasn't his intention, but you know, if it turns out that the money he gave will ultimately go to benefit an idol, Torah never prohibited that. And so again, as long as the Jew was not himself benefiting from the nice fragrance of the decorations, it would be permitted. However, Rabbi Yochanan, said, not true. Rabbi Yochanan said, afilu mutaras beperos nam yasser. Even if the decorations were from fruit, where there was no particular fragrance, would still be prohibited because of the fact that you know, this is a store where part of the proceeds are going to go to the idol. And Rabbi Yochanan argues that surely benefiting the idol is biblically prohibited. He argues it's kal v'chomer. You can make a kal v'chomer. If nena aser, if the Torah, based on the pasuk that Rish Lakish just quoted, says there's even a prohibition to benefit from an idol, mehaneh l'kol shekein, to go ahead and do something that benefits the idol, certainly that's prohibited. And so Rabbi Yochanan says the Mishnah is, you know, categorically prohibiting the Jew from patronizing a store that has those decorations, which again indicate that part of that money will go to the idol. Rabbi Yochanan says it's biblically prohibited to cause any benefit to an idol.
You've been listening to RealClearDaf.com. Visit us online for resources or to dedicate a shiur. To speak with Rabbi Wise, call 855-ASK-RCD-1. That's 855-275-7231.